Hello and welcome to episode 64 of Ardent Run Club. I'm Tommy, I'm your host, and today I'm joined by a legend. Yep, he's from the Northeast. Yep, he's running the Commonwealth Games, he's running the Olympics, he's won the London Marathon, and yep, he's one of the greatest British runners ever. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the one and only Charlie Spedding.
Well, thank you. That was quite an introduction. One of the best I've ever had. Thank you very much, Tommy.
Yes, off to a good start. Hey, Charlie, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks.
Good. It's such a pleasure to have you on. I don't know if you've heard some of the previous podcasts, but a lot of the runners that I've spoken to, most of them being from the Northeast, have said that you're one of their inspirations and have said, because I usually ask, oh, what's your favorite book? A lot of them have said From Lust to First as well. So we've got plenty to talk about today, but I'm just so honored to have you on. So thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
Awesome. So let's just get right into it. We're going to start from the beginning and we'll go all the way through your career. Well, all the way through your career. We'll see. And then we'll just go. So I guess the first question I got for you to start off with is, what got you into running, Charlie?
Well, it was at school, like most people. I was about 8 or 9 years old, and we had to do this cross-country run. They call it a cross-country run. It was about a mile and a half around some footpaths. But for an eight-year-old, it felt like a distance race. And we set off, and most of the kids ran until they were out of sight of the teacher and then walked. But there are a few of us trying hard, and I tried really hard, and I came second in that. I was beaten by one of the kids at the school, and it was one of the most successful things I'd ever done, because when I was young, I was pretty much bottom of the class academically. My eyesight isn't great. I wasn't very good at ball games. I was pretty hopeless at most things when I was that age, and this was the first thing I'd been successful at. So whenever we had any other runs, I used to try as hard as I could. And at that school, in my age group, I always finished first or second. Mm. And this other guy, Dennis was his name, he beat me if he felt like it, but he didn't always feel like it. So that was how I got into it. It was the first thing I'd been any good at. And I felt like, so I did a bit of extra running, and I called it training. It was just going for a few runs. Mm-hmm. And I got better. And I liked that immediate response. I did a bit of training, I got better. And I thought, well, yeah, let's stick at this because I like it.
That's awesome. So when did you decide, I don't know, did you join a club straight away or did you?
No, I was running for the school, mm-hmm. and the school, and I started to do quite well. I was winning some inter-school races where we run against another school, some that I didn't win, but some I did. And I thought I should join a running club. So I joined a running club when I was 16. Mm-hmm. And so I was running in school races on a Wednesday, and then I was running for the club, racing for the club on a Saturday. Awesome. So I was really fully into it and enjoying it.
Which club was it?
Gateshead Harriers. And I was lucky to join Gateshead Harriers because there were a lot of great runners there who helped me a lot. And just simply being in a club that had older guys than me, but not a lot older, going off to compete in national championships and international championships, raised my sights. I thought, well, I train with these guys every week, and they're going off to the Olympics and everything. So perhaps it's not that strange to do that. So I didn't think I was going to do it there and then, but it made me think ordinary guys go to the Olympics. It's not just, well, I guess they're not ordinary in a lot of ways, but they're just regular guys, but very good at what they do. So it opened up my my visions and sights quite a lot, being in that club.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like when you surround yourself with greatness, like that's kind of what you're seeing.
A little bit of it rubs off.
Yeah, that's great. So what was your favorite distance to run in the early days?
Well, I used to try and run the mile. I used to I used to like to do it, but I think probably 3,000 meters.
Yeah.
The mile 3,000 meters were kind of when I was teenage. I think I liked those and road races.
Yeah.
At that age, you know, probably when I first joined the club, we were in 3 or 4 mile road races, and I enjoyed that. But then, just I guess I always liked as a senior, I always liked a 10K road race.
Yeah.
Sort of distance that's long enough to be a distance race, but short enough that it's not really hard.
Exactly. Yeah, that's awesome. It's kind of a sweet spot between the half marathon and the 5K. The 5K is really fast and painful.
Yeah.
The half marathon is long and painful.
Yeah.
10K, you get to pace yourself a bit better. That's awesome. Yeah. And so what did training look like as you, so obviously you're at Gateshead Harriers, you're training with some of the faster, older chaps, and then you move into like getting better, getting older into your early 20s, and then just essentially become a professional. How did training change and what did it look like for you?
Well, I by the time I was in my 20s and running in senior races, I was training 7 days a week. On a Sunday, in a big group of us, we'd do a long run, the 15 miles and quite often 20 miles. And I think my marathon training started very early without me realizing it, because on a Sunday I'd often run 20 miles in my early 20s with a group of other guys in Gateshead Harriers. But my total mileage was probably only 70 miles a week. So lots of days, it was one day of the week I'd run a long way. But I was training every day and maybe doing two faster sessions on the club night was Tuesday. We'd all get together and do faster running and one other day of the week. But I'm racing most weekends, not all of them, but I used to race quite a lot and I like racing, and racing was the best preparation for other races as well. And it just developed like that. Over a long period of time, I realized that I was following a system that had been made famous by Arthur Lydiard, the coach of a lot of New Zealand athletes, Peter Snell, who won double Olympic gold and stuff. And everyone followed it. And it consisted of lots of long distance running in the winter to build your strength and stamina, then a transition phase of hill running in the spring, and then lots of speed work for racing on the track. And that worked brilliantly for someone like Peter Snell, who had fantastic basic speed. And all he needed to do was get stronger to hold that speed. And that's how he won the 1500 meter gold medal in the Olympics. But I had no real basic speed. And I was doing all this. And so I took too long to realize this, but I spent a lot of years doing this Arthur Lydiard type training, getting really strong. And then, but it took me all summer to build up any speed, and because I didn't have any real basic speed. And much later on in my life, in my running career, I thought that, well, this isn't working. And I started to change it and adjusted to doing a lot more pace work throughout the year to maintain the little bit of real speed I've got.
Right.
And that made a huge difference. And I was I was injured less because I was trying to run fast on legs that weren't used to running fast. And so when I changed it to much more pace work during the whole year, I ran much, much better.
That's brilliant. And so when you think back to that sort of pace work and pace-based training, did you have a favorite session that you used to do? Or was it maybe, I don't know how professionals think, is it all fun?
Oh, no, that's not all fun.
Okay.
and when you call me a professional athlete, you have to remember that I was running at a time when it was completely amateur, and I was working for a living throughout it. So I take it as professional in terms of my approach to it.
Right.
Was professional. but there was no money involved until right at the end of my career when it became open. But yeah, when you say professional, most people think, oh, he was making money out of it. Well, I wasn't.
Okay.
But if I had been, I don't think I would have been any more committed than I was. But I had to work during the day, doing a living. I've forgotten what you asked me.
I said, what was your favorite sort of session to do?
Well, during the winter, when I talk about pace, I wasn't running really, really fast, but I was running much faster than I would out on the run. So I was doing things on the track, like two repetitions of 800 meters, followed by running 1600 meters, four laps of the track at the same pace, then back to two 800s, and then a mile or 1600 meters at the same pace. Not super well for me. That was around about 2:11, 2:12 for the 800s, and then about a 4:24 for 1600 meters, which was a tough bit of the session, trying to keep that going. And doing that type of session during the winter, and then I would be doing things that were a bit faster during the summer, but that maintained a great deal of pace in my legs and body, and it really worked for me a lot.
That's good. And you obviously, we had a little chuckle there saying that you didn't like all of the training. Was there a specific session or a type of session that you just didn't like doing, but you knew you had to do?
Yeah. Well, some of them are just physically very, very hard.
Mm-hmm.
When I was running on the track, when I was trying to peak for a race, I used to do a session of eight by 200 meters. Now, that doesn't sound too hard, but I used to have 20 seconds recovery in between them.
Okay.
So I'd run an 800 in about 30 seconds, and basically you've got time to slow down, turn around, dog back behind the start line, and go again. And the first couple are okay, but by the time you get to 7 and 8, you're in huge oxygen debt because you're not recovering from each one. Mm. So that's tough. That type of session is really tough.
Yeah.
But it used to, and I used to save it for when I was trying to get ready for a really big race. It used to help me a lot. But you've got to do some sessions where you've got to dig very deep and hurt yourself to to move on,
to improve,
to really race your absolute best.
That's awesome. And so all this training, did you have a coach?
Well, I never really had someone who I would strictly call my coach, but a good friend of mine called Lindsay Dunn used to help me enormously. And he wouldn't say he coached me, because the people he did coach, he used to tell them what to do every day, and he wanted them to do exactly that. And I didn't want that relationship, but he was very happy to help me. And we used to discuss things a lot. And he just devised some sessions for me, which were absolutely tremendous. But we'd always discuss everything. And there were times when I'd go to him with a plan for the summer. It was two, and he would say, well, I don't like these two things you're planning to do. And we'd discuss why. And I remember one year I disagreed, and I said, no, I'm going to keep this, and I'm going to agree with you on that. And we both agreed at the end of the summer, where I had a good summer, I'd ended up with the right decision. So he changed my mind on one of them and not on the other. And it really, the result of us both discussing it really worked well. But he used to do some brilliant sessions occasionally, again, when I was getting ready for a big race, where I'd go to the track and he wouldn't tell me what I had to do, but he'd devised a session, and I'd warm up and get ready, and I'd have to jog up the line. As I jogged up the line, he'd tell me to run 500 meters at a 64 second pace. So I'd do it, and then he'd tell me how much jog I've got, and then he'd get me into a bit of oxygen debt, and then he'd say, okay, just run at 70 seconds per lap pace until I tell you to stop. and I'd run a lap and then another one and then a third one. And I'd think, how long am I going to have to do this for? And I'd run maybe four laps and then let me have a good. And then we'd go through a whole series of things. And every time, he always judged it really well. But every time, because I didn't know what I was going to do or how long it was going to last, he'd get me to jog up to the line, ready to go again, thinking, what's he going to do this time? And then he'd say, okay, you're finished. And he caught me with it every time because he could. I can't swear on this podcast, so I can't tell you what I would say to him. But he got me every time.
What a legend. Oh my goodness. Yeah.
He was a fantastic coach. He coached so many people to national titles and international events. He was brilliant.
Yeah.
But he always had that sense of humor as well.
Yeah, we've actually had a few of his athletes on the podcast, and they say the exact same sort of stuff. It's all good fun by the sounds of things. It sounds like you guys had a relationship that was just beyond athletics, though. It sounds like.
We were good friends, and for decades after, we used to meet on a Tuesday night because it used to be club night, and a group of guys would go for something to eat after we'd trained, and that dynamic kind of changed. But Lindsay and I kept doing it, going for something to eat. Except neither of us were going training anymore. Yeah. He'd take a group and then he'd come and join me. And it kept me in touch with the sport long after I'd stopped competing, meeting up with Lindsay every week and because he was still deeply involved in it. And it kept me in touch with the sport, and it was brilliant. And sadly, he died a couple of years ago, and he is a great loss. A huge loss.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think his legacy looks like? What do you think it will be?
Well, it's in the record books of all the people he coached, but he has also taken under his wing other coaches and taught them his methods, and younger guys, and they're continuing to use and develop his methods. So his legacy lives on.
That's amazing. Yeah, it's so true. Wow, what a deep relationship, and I love that it goes beyond just the training, beyond just the athletes, but it's a really good friendship, and I think that speaks to the sport of running as well, that it's not just like everyone thinks it's really individual, because it's obviously just you out there on the track or on the road by yourself and you're winning for yourself, but it's the community that makes the sport great.
Absolutely. You're right. As competitors, it's individual, except, of course, there are team races and so on, but very much individual. But I think the thing is that everyone involved knows that what it's like. And we're racing against other people, but we're also racing against the distance that we're running. And I've always found that even with my biggest rivals, there's this great camaraderie.
Yeah.
And, you know, recently I bumped into some guys I used to train with and run with that I hadn't seen for over 10 years, 15 years. And it was just like I'd seen them last week. And, you know, you're just all friends again.
That's brilliant.
I love it.
Let's talk a little bit about your racing then. So obviously you've done a lot of great things in the sport, but if you could name one moment, one favorite moment, one favorite race, what would that be?
Well, the favorite race for me absolutely has to be the Los Angeles Olympic Marathon. Mm-hmm. My greatest success by a mile, but also my favorite race for the way I ran it. I got the bronze medal. I didn't get the bronze medal because I was one of the top three most talented runners in that race, because I wasn't, but I ran the best race of my life and produced the best performance of my life, which allowed me to exceed the expectations of almost everybody. So that's got to be my favorite race, absolutely.
That's awesome. Were you at your peak fitness and everything just went well? Was that what it was like?
Well, I was at peak fitness, but I had spent a great deal of time and effort preparing my mind and my attitude for it. And it was only the third marathon I'd run, and I'd won the other two in Houston. My first marathon was in Houston. Then I won the London Marathon, which was the trial for the team. So I got into the Olympic team through doing that. And I convinced myself that, one day every competitive runner runs the greatest race of their career. And when you're retired, you can look back and think, what was that day? That was the day I ran the best race ever. And I thought, well, why would you want that to happen in something like a park run? Nothing wrong with park run, but if you're a competitive runner, you want it to happen in the biggest race. So I convinced myself that I was going to run the best race of my life in the biggest race of my life, which was obviously the Olympic Games.
Yeah.
And I convinced myself that that would happen. And the thing is that, it's no good trying to convince yourself I'm going to win a medal, because you might run great, but 3, 4, 5, 6 other guys might run better and you don't get it. But you can run the greatest race of your life. You don't know where it'll get you, but it will get you the best result you can possibly get. And I totally convinced myself that that would happen. And I ran the race as if that was going to happen. And we've all got this kind of picture of ourselves and our subconscious minds of what we can do and what we can't do. And by convincing myself I was going to run better than I'd ever run before, I didn't know how good that could be. So it kind of took the lid off what I thought I could do and opened it up to who knows what I can do. So I ran the race in that frame of mind and went for it in ways that without that frame of mind, I may not have done. So it gave me this extra boost of confidence to really go for it.
Was it like just constantly visualizing and just repeating, like, I've done the training, I've done the work, or?
It was a lot of visualization, but I never visualized the finish deliberately because I didn't know what would happen. I visualized myself running fluently, efficiently, running absolutely great, moving smoothly across the ground, in control, and visualized later on in the race where it was obviously going to be hard, really working hard, hurting, but moving beautifully, efficiently. And I visualized that and never visualized the end because I didn't know what the end of the race would be. But I knew that if I ran the first 20, 22, 23 miles as efficiently as I could, the way I was visualizing it, then I would be set as well as I could be to run the real crunch of the race over the last few miles.
Yeah, no, that's really good. I don't think I've had anyone on the podcast talk about that sort of thing. Now, obviously, it's a lot of talk about the hard work of training, but maybe the mindset and that sort of thing is underrated.
I really believe so. Yeah, you've got to be as fit as you possibly can be, and as well prepared physically as you possibly can be. But I've heard other runners say things like, I've done the training, the race will take care of itself. And I completely disagree with that. You've got to do the training because everyone else has done the training. it's a prerequisite for showing up.
Yeah.
Being as fit as you possibly can be is just, it's the start.
Yeah.
There's no point in going it if you're not in great shape. So then it becomes how well you perform. And that to me is controlled by your mind.
Yeah.
So getting my mind right was absolutely the most important. Well, it was the most important thing once I was standing on the start line.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
As fit as I was. And I had trained very well.
Yeah.
Training never goes perfectly, but I was very happy with my training. And yeah. I knew I was ready to run well.
Yeah. That's awesome. I feel like I'm about to ruin the extraordinary motivational vibes right now, but did you ever have a really bad race as well?
Oh gosh, yeah. I had loads of bad races. I had stacked bad races.
What would be a standout?
Well, there are two ways in which to have a bad race. One is to just make a bad decision, and the other is just to run badly. One really bad race I remember was the last race I ran before my first marathon, mm-hmm. which was the Boxing Day road race in Gateshead. It used to be, it was called the Saltwell Road Race. Before that, it was called the Congers Road Race. And it used to go along the Team Valley and along the main road through Gateshead. But they stopped that after I was running it. And it was a popular road race on Boxing Day. And it was the last race I was going to run before my first marathon in Houston, which was about 2 weeks later. Mm-hmm. And I'd won that in the past, and I'd been second in it probably three times to Mike McLeod. And I ran it thinking I was in great shape, and I finished 28th, which by a long way is the worst position I've ever finished in a Northeast road race. And I was beaten by people who had never beaten me before over any distance. And the local press were asking me afterwards, well, are you still going to run in Houston after you've run so badly? And I said, yeah. And I ran great in Houston.
Yeah.
And won the race. But I think what happened was that because I knew I was going to run this big marathon, subconsciously, I just couldn't. I thought I was trying as hard as I could, but subconsciously, I think I was holding it back for Houston.
Mm.
And not deliberately, but I just couldn't perform.
Wow.
So that was probably the worst local road race I ever ran by quite a long way. But it was the last one before I won a marathon.
But that speaks, like you just spoken about the mindset of visualizing it. And then again, like what the subconscious does when, like it's crazy how the mind is able to do that to you. Like for the better and for the worse.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It can affect you, as you say, for the better or worse.
So I know that was your last race before doing a marathon, but did you take anything from that into the marathon?
I need to ignore that, completely forget about it. Just forget about it, don't think about it. And I was able to just dismiss it. And I thought, that's a one-off. My training says I'm running well.
That's good.
I figured out within a few days, I thought, that's just me saving myself for the marathon without deliberately doing it. And that was clearly what happened.
Yeah, that's good. And it's good that you were able to just like block it out and then go forwards from there and not let it hurt you. And obviously you came away from Houston with the win. Into a really good marathon career. So that's really good. You obviously just mentioned a few moments ago the Olympics in Los Angeles, right? Is that 1984? Is that?
Yes.
So back then, what was the Olympics like? Was it like Olympic Village and all the opening ceremony and everything as big as it is right now, but on a different...
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it was. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was. It was huge, huge event. The Olympic Village was interesting. I didn't actually get to Los Angeles until the games had started, because the marathon was on the very last day of the games. So I didn't want to be there for too long. I was there for 6 or 7 days, and I'd been training over in Boston on the east coast of America,
mm-hmm.
Where I'd been before, and I knew my way around, and I knew people. So I had a 3-hour time change to get across Los Angeles. So I was in the Olympic Village for, I can't remember exactly, it was about a week, might have just been 6 days. And early on in the Olympic Games, it's all, you see all these famous athletes everywhere you go, in all sorts of different sports, not just athletics. And it's extraordinary to see them all. And early on, the atmosphere is very, very professional. Everyone's concentrating on their event, and they're all keyed up and ready for it. And but as the games progress, more and more people have finished competing, and the atmosphere in the village just changes. And all the people who finished are wanting to party. and when you come to the marathon, which is the very last day, everybody else has finished.
Yeah.
and I'm trying to go to bed and get some sleep before the biggest race of my life. And everybody else in the village is, apart from the marathon runners, are wanting to party.
Yeah.
So it's quite, that's another mental challenge that you have to deal with. But, you know, you have to deal with it. And that's how it is. But it's an interesting process, the way the atmosphere changes as the days go by.
Yeah. Who, side note, who was the biggest or most famous athlete that you saw in person at the Olympic Games?
Wow, a lot. Carl Lewis, the American sprinter.
Yeah, sheesh.
But, you know, there were some very big names on the British team. Seb Coe won a gold medal. Daley Thompson won the decathlon. There were so many famous athletes there. It's hard to pick one out.
Yeah, that's awesome. So when you were getting ready for that race, and you know, you're there for the week, and everyone's trying to finish and go home and have fun and all that sort of stuff, you're trying to focus. Were you nervous before that race?
Oh, good grief. I've never been so nervous in my life. I was nervous for the whole week beforehand. Really, really nervous. And doing very little training during the last week, not doing much training. I'm really used to taper off a lot and trying to fill my time, but finding it hard to concentrate on anything. They had, you know, in the village that they had a cinema you could go to. And I would sit in the cool, out of the sun and the heat, watching a movie. And, you know, after 10 minutes, I would be thinking, well, what just happened? Because I wasn't actually, I was thinking about my race instead of the movie I'm watching. And I would try to read books, and I would have to read the same page a few times because I couldn't concentrate on it. And when it came to the actual day of the race, and we went on a coach to the start, and then you went into this big gymnasium. It was at a college track, and there was this big gymnasium, and then all the best marathon runners in the world were in this room. And that was when the nerves really hit me. And I did a tiny bit of jogging to warm up, and then I was changing my shoes into the shoes I was going to race in. I was struggling to tie the laces because my hands were shaking. Yeah. And I was incredibly nervous. And I actually realized I was getting too nervous. And I went outside into the sunshine, which is really hot, beside the track. And there's nobody else there. And just had a talk to myself about how I was seeing this as big, all these great runners being there, being this huge problem. But I went outside and I thought, turn this around, it's not doing you any good. And I thought to myself, well, all these great runners being here, that's an opportunity. If I run one brilliant race, look at how many great runners I could beat in one go. And I was still very nervous, but it just calmed me down enough to think, this isn't a problem, it's an opportunity.
Yeah.
And I went to the start line thinking like that. And as soon as we'd run 400 yards, my nervousness had gone, and I was into racing mode. And but the nerves beforehand are huge because it's such a huge event. And I knew it was the biggest race I would probably ever run. And it was a huge opportunity for me.
Yeah.
And there are two things going on there. There's the fear of failure. There's the fear that you might actually just make a real mess of it and fail.
Mm.
But there's also the fear of success, which is something people don't usually talk about. The fear that you might do brilliantly well and it changes your life. I used to go when I was in Boston in the weeks beforehand. I went once a week to get a massage on my legs, and this guy I saw was brilliant at it. But he was an interesting guy, and he actually asked me. He said, and we were talking about the marathon, and he asked me, you know, if you win this race, what will you lose? And I hadn't actually thought about that, and I said, that's a brilliant question.
Yeah.
And he said, you probably want to think about it. And I thought, well, my life would change. My whole life would change. I came third. My life didn't change that much. But here we are talking.
Yeah.
40 years later, and we probably wouldn't be if I hadn't got a medal. So it did change, but you know, if you become Olympic champion, your entire life changes, and you need to be prepared for that, because if you are heading, you think you've got a chance of winning, and your subconscious mind says, I don't want to be famous, I don't want to be known by everybody, it's going to find a way to slow you down. So you've got to sort that out beforehand. Interesting thought, but it just adds to the nerves, you know, the fear of failure and the fear of success.
Yeah.
Because it's such a big event.
It's amazing, though, that even an Olympian can feel that nervous before a race. I think that's something that should encourage everyone that listens, that goes to even the local races and gets nervous. Like, don't worry, even the Olympians get nervous. And flip a nerve at that.
In races, I didn't get nervous then. I didn't run as well as I should have done. You need a bit of nerves to get you to run really well. It's just that becoming too nervous for too long beforehand can become a stress, and it can make you run worse if you don't control it.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got to get it right, but you've got to be nervous to some extent.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering, I haven't watched that race, but just tell me, was it a leading pack throughout the whole thing? Did somebody go far ahead of everybody, or what was that race like?
We ran for about 6 miles in an enormous pack, at a decent pace, but not really fast, but it was very hot. And then after about 6 miles, a couple of the African guys who at that time were all, lots of them would just surge in races. They'd just do these crazy surges. And a couple of them just surged away. And I thought, that's a crazy speed to go in this heat after only 6 miles.
Mm-hmm.
But a few other people went with them. And then I saw some of the race favorites go with it. And I thought, I've got to go with that. I've told myself I'm going to run the greatest race of my life. I can't let some of the best runners in the world just run away from me after 6 miles. I've got to go with it. So I had to run really hard for about a mile, from 6 miles to 7 miles, which isn't ideal, but was far worse to let them get away, because people, some of the favorites who did let them get away, never got back into the race.
Wow.
Their chances were gone after only 6 miles. So I got into that leading group, and it was a leading group of about 10, and we ran together for a very long way. And I had visualized that, you know, beyond 20 miles, someone like the world champion, Rob Di Castella, would push the pace really hard. And I visualized tucking in behind him and going with him and holding on and all this kind of stuff. And we got to about 22 miles, and I was looking around the group, and I looked around, and Rob Di Castella was actually starting to tail off the back. I thought, he's not going to do it. And I looked at the other people in the group and thought, they're not going to do it. There's no everyone here, apart from me, would probably be quite happy to take their chances in a sprint for the finish at the end. I said, that won't work for me. And then it struck me that I was going to have to do it. And all the visualization I'd gone through, and I had thought of every scenario there was, it had never occurred to me that I'd be in the leading group at 22 miles, and I would think, we're not going fast enough. But that was what was happening. I would think, for me, we need to pick this pace up, because I'm not that I was jogging along. We were running 5-minute mile pace, maybe slightly under, but I knew my best chances were with a long, hard run for home. And so at about 22 miles, I had to spend a few minutes convincing myself I was going to do this. 22 miles, I went to the front and just wound the pace up, and I led for getting on for a mile, and really was moving pretty quick, and the group behind me went down to just four of us through that move. This is what I was talking about, really, about convincing myself I'd run the greatest race of my life. I would never have dared do that if I didn't have that frame of mind. But I did. I thought, I'm going to run the greatest race of my life today, so I've got to go and do it. And it got us down to four, and I thought, oh no, there's four of us, and if I keep leading, they'll all sit on me, and I'll finish. So I'll take a breather. And I tucked in behind John Tracy and Carlos Lopez, the two guys who ended up beating me. I thought, I'll tuck in and try again later. But after 200, 300 yards, Carlos Lopez just changed gears, and away he went. I tried to go with him, but I just couldn't stay with him. And John Tracy came beside me, but he couldn't get past me. Lopez was going away. Tracy and I were running together, and I glanced behind, and the fourth guy, called Joseph and Zhao from Kenya, was way back, big gap behind me. And I had this sudden moment where I thought, I'm going to win a medal. I'm going to win a medal. Mm. And I got kind of excited. And then we went past the sign that said 37 kilometers. So I had 5 kilometers still to go. Yeah. And I thought, whoa. Stop getting excited. I'm going to win a medal if I can stay here for another 5K. So I then, I got excited for a moment, saw this sign, and went straight back into race mode, focus. And those were a very long 5K, because it was really hurting by now.
Yeah.
And John Tracy and I stayed together for that whole time, until we were just outside the stadium. He kind of jumped me, got a gap on me going through the tunnel. I thought, I've got to catch him before the track. I ran really hard, caught him. I was just behind him, came on the track, and he had to run down the home straight and then a lap of the track. And I was right behind him with 400 meters to go, getting the back straight. I'd used all my gears catching him, and he pulled away from me and beat me by 2 seconds. And I was about a minute ahead of the next guy. So that was how the race went. But I think the important thing was there were two crunch moments. One at 6 miles, when I thought they were going too fast, but thought, I've got to go with them. So I made the aggressive decision and got in the leading group. Mm-hmm. And then at about 22 miles, I made the aggressive decision and thought, I'm going to pick this pace up and stretch everybody. So it was being aggressive, but not going crazy, that got me into the position to win the medal.
I know people that say that marathons are boring. They're like, how can you sit down for 2.5 hours just watching a race? I'm fully gonna go and watch that whole race now, because that is crazy.
It is a good race to watch, actually. Some marathons are boring, but this is a real competitive race.
Yeah,
it is. You should watch it.
Yeah, thank you. Oh my goodness, that's nuts. I'm just imagining you and John Tracy going stride for stride, just thinking, oh, I've got to get this guy, I'm going to beat this guy. And then you're like, oh man, That would have been good. That must have been good. I'm going to watch that. Crazy. Awesome. Wow. We're going for a while, but I'm loving this. Let's talk a little bit about, well, we'll talk a bit about injuries and then we'll talk about your career post running. So you mentioned earlier that when you changed your training from what Peter Snell was doing with the long and then the quick stuff, you changed to more pace-based running. How, you said you didn't get injured as much. So what was your worst injury overall in your career?
Well, I had a lot of problems with my Achilles tendons, a lot of problems. And in fact, I had four lots of surgery, two on each leg, 10 years apart, because I kept getting problems with them. And
that's crazy.
Those were by far the worst things. Yeah. But they caused quite a lot of problems at times, because I would get an injury, I'd have to take it easy, rest, I'd get better, I'd build up my training, and it would come back again. So frustrating, and unable to move on because of it. I ended up having surgery. Those were big problems at times. When I didn't have any injury problems for an extended spell, I had by far my best few years of running.
Yeah. So I was going through the book that we'll talk about soon, and there's a chapter in there called, I think it is, I Thought I Was Going to Die, or I Almost Died.
Yeah. The first Achilles tendon operation I went for, I was about 23 years old. They gave me a general anesthetic, and I had an allergic reaction to one of the drugs they give you. And I had a thing called anaphylactic shock, which is where you get an allergic reaction over your entire body. It kills a lot of people who get it. And if I hadn't been in a hospital to start with, if you have an anaphylactic shock outside somewhere, you probably got a slim chance of surviving it. But they pumped me full of drugs to correct it. And the anaesthetist came to see me, because I had to stay in hospital for a few days afterwards to recover. The anaesthetist came to see me afterwards, and he said to me, if I hadn't noticed something was wrong for another 30 seconds, I don't think you'd have survived. So yeah. They got stuck into me fast enough that I survived, but I had to be in intensive care for a while to make sure that I was okay. Yeah. Which I was, obviously. But it was a scary moment.
Yeah, that's really scary. Goodness me. But you were able to recover and then get back about your life.
Yeah, I recovered, and I went back to the same hospital 3 weeks later and had the operation under local anaesthetic.
Yeah.
Where you have to keep really still. Put it inside your leg and you're awake.
Of course. Oh my goodness. Wow. All right. That's some serious stuff. So lots of injuries and a near death experience, I guess.
Yeah.
That's a bit crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. I've had ups and downs.
Yeah, that's awesome. What what do you think your biggest goal was as a professional runner?
My biggest goal was always to be the best that I could.
Yeah.
And that went on for years. Obviously, in particular years and seasons, I'd have more specific goals, but the overriding goal was always to become the best that I can. So whatever level I reached, I'd try and consolidate there, become steady there, but then always aim, try to be better, and always try. And that's how I ended up at the Olympics. Took me a long time, but just continually, well, I'm at this level, what about the next level?
Mm. And would you say that flat speed, I guess, like the track pace, would you say that was your biggest weakness in your running?
Yes, on the track. My ability to finish fast, I don't have the ability to finish fast. That was a problem on the track. The only track races I won by getting a gap with, a few laps to go and holding on. But I I did become a decent 10K runner. I won the 3S 10,000 meter championship. I was fourth in the Commonwealth Games. I was a decent 10K runner. And thanks to Lindsay Dunn, he got me to work on 10K for a few years to become absolutely as good as I could at 10K before I moved to the marathon. So actually my track speed helped me in the marathon, because I'd become as good as I could at 10K. And you've got to be a good 10K runner to be a good marathon runner, because you've got to be able to run fast enough. And by becoming the best 10K runner I could be, I was then able to become the marathon runner I was, because of that sort of speed endurance that I had. I could hold, I can't sprint fast, but I can hold a fast pace for a long time, which is what a good marathon is really.
Yeah, I think those, to be fair, like when I watch the track races, it's like, for instance, 1500 meters, it's the 1500 meter runners, the races where it's just spread out from the start because somebody's going really hard. Those are the best ones to watch, rather than, like, I don't know, in the 2016 Olympics, it was a good race because everyone was there at the end, but it was really, really slow compared to this Olympics just gone. It was 350 and this one just gone was, I think it was 328. So,
It's
very difficult. Everyone's working hard and properly racing, you know.
I like those races best as well. Whereas in a lot of 1500 meter races, nobody wants to lead, so no one does, and they just kind of jog around, and it just becomes who can sprint the last lap fastest.
Exactly. Yeah. Personal preference, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, do you still do any running?
No, I do lots of walking. Mm-hmm. I walk a lot every day, and sometimes when I'm out walking through the woods, I might just break into a run because I feel like it. But I only run 50 to 100 yards. But that feeling of running, I still like. But I'm not fit enough to keep it going very long. So I'll run a bit. I might walk a bit. I might run a bit again I feel like it. Yeah, but I keep it by doing lots of a lot of walking.
Yeah.
And in warmer weather than we've got now, some cycling. I like riding a bike as well. I'll do some cycling in the summer, but I don't like cycling in the cold and wet, so I don't do it.
Fair enough. Do you miss running?
I did for quite a lot of years after I finished competing. But as the years have gone by, I'm still interested. I still love to watch it, keep interested. Yeah. But I don't feel like I miss it the way I did.
Yeah.
But when I stopped competing, I did miss it quite a lot for a few years.
Yeah. And are you still involved in the sport?
Not in any official way at all.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, before we go into into the post-career stuff, what would you say the biggest thing you learned about yourself through running was?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I learned that with a lot of patience and effort and the right attitude, I believe lots of other people can achieve things in time that you wouldn't have believed at the start of the process. And I think I really think that's a big lesson for life for everybody, that, ideas come to my mind like, you know, it'll take you 10 years to achieve this. And so that's too long. But I say, well, those 10 years will pass, you know, and in 10 years time, you've either done it or you haven't. So why not try? Yeah. And I think that, I think that's the biggest thing that I absolutely surprised myself and probably a lot of other people with what I eventually achieved, because you wouldn't have guessed it from early on.
You
can take that into other parts of life.
Yeah, no, that's so good. I think I have a similar mindset with my business and work and all that sort of stuff, is that, the time, it's going to take a long time to build what you want to build, but that time is going to pass, so.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you've either done it or you haven't.
Exactly, 100%. That's brilliant. So let's talk about this. So you've written this book, From Last to First. It's very nice. Look at the big smile there.
Well, if you don't smile when you cross the line, when you win a race like that, there's something wrong.
Yeah, exactly. So what was the reason for writing this book?
Well, all those things we've been talking about,
yeah.
I felt like I wanted to explain how I'd achieved what I did. And I also thought it was an interesting story. And I thought having won an Olympic medal, it was legitimate for me to write a book about what I'd done.
Yeah.
Anyone can write a book about what they've done. They don't have to have done that. But I thought if I'm going to write about a career, perhaps, you know, people would be interested in reading it, seeing as I've got that. But I thought the whole story about my mental processes and all those things would be interesting and useful.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to tell that story.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And I have had a lot of people tell me that they've found parts of the book really useful in their career, which is very rewarding for me I've actually helped people.
Oh, for sure. So, and I forgot to ask, when did you actually put this book together?
Well, it took, like my running career, it took a very, very long time because I was working, I had a young family, I was trying to write it in my spare time, but you don't have any spare time, will you?
No.
So it took me quite a lot of years. And I've forgotten when it came out. It'll say in there. It's in the right in the front. I've forgotten when it came out.
Let's have a look. Dear me.
Got a 2009. That's it. 2009 is when it first came out.
Yeah,
2009. Yeah, I remember now.
That's awesome. So
that's
13 years ago.
13 years. Yeah.
Wow. Legacy. That's awesome. And the other thing that you're doing now, and I remember when I chatted to you briefly before when we were trying to arrange this. I was like, when I found you on Facebook, I was like, what's this stop feeding us lies thing? Is this the real Charlie Spedding? Like, doesn't look like anything to do with running. So what's this? So tell us a little bit about that. What's that?
Well, my real career, my professional career, where I've earned a living, has been as a pharmacist. So yeah. I've worked as a pharmacist. I've been in medicine and healthcare throughout my life, apart from little spells when I stepped out of it for my running.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, later on in my pharmacy career, I realized that there were so many people coming to my pharmacy taking medicine month after month, year after year, but never getting better because the drugs were treating the symptoms of their disease and not the root cause. And I was frustrated and disappointed by this. And so I actually left pharmacy a little bit earlier than I'd intended to originally. And I kind of got into studying the root cause of all our health problems. And it all is down to, well, it's lifestyle, but the most important thing is diet. And an awful lot of people have a terrible diet, but the problem's worse than that because we're actually advised to eat a diet that I don't think, and a lot of other people don't think, is the correct one for human beings. And it's why we have so much obesity and diabetes and all these other things, which obviously I've been interested in my entire life.
Mm.
So, and I was originally going to call the book something about health and happiness, and that's in the subtitle.
Yeah.
But the more research I did, the more lies and dogma and propaganda and corruption I found. So Stop Feeding Us Lies became an appropriate title. Yeah. And again, it's only been out for a couple of years, but I've had people, I had a message recently from a stranger who told me she was a nurse working for the NHS and she was morbidly obese, had been on yo-yo diet, had tried all sorts of well-known diet programs, read my book, changed her diet, and she's lost 6 stone in weight and feels considerably better.
That's good.
So it's a major problem in the country. Obviously, not for fine athletes like you and me, but for a huge number of people.
Yeah.
Weight and all the health problems it brings is an enormous problem. And lots of the stuff we're told is just wrong. And so I've written about it, but the book's more wide ranging than that. It goes into a lot more health issues than that.
Yeah.
But that's what it's about, and that's what I'm trying to work on nowadays. But it's hard to get into the mainstream media because I'm criticizing the consensus.
Yeah.
And mainstream media don't want to know.
Yeah.
I keep working at it. I'm not going to give in.
Good.
Marathon runners don't give in.
Exactly. Well, mainstream media might not want to know, but I'm sure some people listening would want to know. So what would you say the staple meal or the right thing for humans?
The thing to avoid is ultra-processed food and too much sugar are the first things. And drinking sugar is a dreadful thing to do. I won't go into the biochemistry of it now because we've been talking for a long time already, but avoid drinking sugar, avoid ultra-processed food. There's a big push worldwide to persuade people to eat less meat. Meat and animal-sourced foods, people's decisions are their own, but meat and animal-sourced foods are the most nutritious foods we can eat, and it's what we ate to evolve into the dominant species on the planet. So to vilify it is completely wrong. So eat lots of... And natural fat has also been vilified for no good reason. So eating real food.
Yeah.
Cut out ultra-processed food. Eat real fresh food that comes from a farmer or a fisherman and not from a factory would be my quick summation of how to have a healthy diet.
That is awesome. Hey, I've got a few lifestyle changes to make now. Somebody that's had a pretty good sporting career, so you know I'm gonna listen. No, Andy's also a pharmacist, that counts, I guess. So yeah. that's brilliant. So I guess we're gonna end in a moment, but before we do, I always do the find your fire round, and it's just a few questions I've got prepared for you just to get to know you a bit more, and then yeah, I guess we'll wrap up after that. So you ready to give it a go?
Well, I'll try.
Awesome. So in fact, before that, sorry, I forgot to ask. You did the Great North Run. How can we be in the Northeast chatting to a Northeast athlete and not talk about the Great North Run? And you ran like 64 minutes, I think, in that one.
I ran it three times.
Okay.
Never got very close to winning it, but I was sort of low end of the top 10, I think.
Yeah.
And ran about 64 minutes. It's a great event, fabulous event, because of crowds all the way. I usually used it as a preparation for something else.
Right.
I never focused on it as this is the race I want to win. It was always often a stepping stone to a marathon or something like that.
Yeah.
But it's a fabulous event, and I couldn't possibly have been a Northeast runner without having done it a few times.
Exactly. That's awesome. All right. Let's get into the Find Your Fire round. I'm glad we just mentioned that. So first question, what is a race that you always wanted to run?
Well, the Olympic Games, which luckily I've done, but the Olympic Marathon, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. What about a location, country that you always wanted to run in?
America, and I spent quite a bit of time in America. I did like running there. Running was really big there, but there are some beautiful places there to run in as well, which I was lucky enough to do. Yep.
Okay, bro. So now I need you to rank for me your from favorite to least favorite cross country, road, and track.
Road favorite, track second, cross country. I used to like training on a cross country, but I didn't like racing it because I wasn't very good at it.
Fair enough. It's also a bit muddy. That's why I don't like it. It's a bit too muddy.
Well, the more muddy it was, the worse I ran.
Yeah, I think that kind of just makes sense. Yeah. All right, your favorite race that you ever seen on TV or live, I guess.
There are so many. But I think actually we came back in when I was very early 20s and really getting into the sport. I watched the Commonwealth Games 1500 meters. It's either, can't remember the year, 71, 72, something like that. The 1500 meter final, stacks of great runners in it, including the Northeast's Brendan Foster, but also John Walker, and a guy called Philbert Bayi from Tanzania went straight out in the lead, and he went so fast everyone let him go when he had a big lead, and he just kept going and kept going, and these big kickers like John Walker, last lap, reeling him in, couldn't get to him, couldn't catch him, and he won it in a new world record. So he front ran by himself a world record to win the gold medal. That was, you know, you mentioned that sort of race before.
Yeah.
That's one of the ones that always stuck in my mind because I was jaw-dropping for me to watch.
That's awesome. I'm literally writing that down right now so I can watch that after this. Final, 1500 meter final, Commonwealth Games. Awesome. All right. I didn't give you this question, but who was your biggest rival when you were competing?
Oh, in the northeast, Mike McLeod on the roads, and he would always outkick me at the finish. There were lots, and it kept changing. In two of the biggest races, John Tracy, who I had a battle with in the Olympics, but in the London Marathon, Steve Jones. When I ran my fastest time, I was up against Steve Jones, and he beat me. But you know, he held the world best for a while. Those are some of the guys that had tough races with when I was running at my best.
Yeah. I was, and also you got Dennis as well from school. Got Dennis as well.
Yeah, that's right.
I was talking to someone last week, and he was like, yeah, running back in the late 70s, 80s and into the 90s in the Northeast, you'd have Brendan Foster, you have Mike McLeod, you have Charlie Spedden, and all the way up to Steve Cram, like lacing up on the for a local 5K. And I just thought, that's a bit nuts that you'd have this many legends all on the start line together. You can watch the race for free. It's not like it's a televised thing. It's just like a local event. That's so cool. Anyway, I just thought I'd mention that. That's really cool. All right, who's your favorite athlete of all time?
Oh, again, that's really hard. I could list so many, but I'll go for Carlos Lopez.
Yeah,
I know he beat me, and you might expect me to dislike him for beating me, but no, he was a fabulous runner. I loved to watch him.
Yeah.
No, I didn't love watching him go away from me, but I love watching him in other races.
Yeah.
Fabulous runner. A fabulous runner without a great sprint finish, which is probably why I also relate to him.
Yeah.
But yeah, great runner. Awesome. World cross country champion twice. Olympic champion. Fabulous runner.
Yeah. And what about outside of running? Do you have a favorite athlete?
That again is a hard one. I might go for someone like Mark Cavendish, the cyclist. Fabulously successful, but modest with it as well. You know, he wins all stacks of sprint races, but he always stressed straight away, it's all down to my team who helped me. So yeah. I like that. You know, he's a great athlete, but he always thanks the people who helped him achieve that.
Humble, isn't it? Yeah, and important.
Yeah.
Okay, what were your favorite running shoes when you were competing?
Oh god, well, they don't make those anymore, I can tell you. I used to run in Nike, they were called Nike Mariah shoes, and they were, I suppose, they were the latest technology back in the 1980s, but these new shoes they have out now look like everyone runs faster in them, so
What are you, controversial one? What are your thoughts on that?
We won't, we won't go there. No.
Fair. No, that's a smart. That's a smart one. Okay. What's your favorite book?
Well, stick to running, and a book called Beer and Brine by a guy called Rob Hadgraft. Sorry. It's about a guy called Walter George, who was the world mile record, British guy, who was the world mile record holder back in 1893. But it's a great story.
Yeah. Okay, awesome. Yeah. Beer and Brine, yeah? Okay. Favorite movie?
Oh, old school, Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah, you're not the first to say that.
No, everyone said it.
Yeah, exactly. But it's a good movie. Yeah, it's legendary. My younger brother's favorite movie as well.
All right.
Yeah, legendary. Okay, a couple more questions. One, who is one person you want to hear on the podcast?
Oh, local runner, Steve Cram.
I think we could make that one work. Steve Cram, the Jarrah Arrow. Yeah, awesome. And then one thing that's still on your bucket list?
Well, I've just completed it, coming on your... your podcast.
Oh goodness. I'm honored. And finally, do you have any hidden talents?
Oh, absolutely not. No, I have no other talents than we've discussed today.
Simple guy.
Yeah. Can't sing, can't dance, can't do any of that.
None of that. Fair enough. You stuck to your strengths and you're pretty successful. That's so good. Awesome. Well, my last question before we end this off then is, do you have any advice for anyone that's getting into running and wants to be really good at it, Charlie?
Well, I guess I said it before, be patient, be consistent, don't give up, and realize that to become really good takes time and effort, but never forget it's worth it.
Brilliant. Awesome. Well, listen, guys, Charlie, are you on social media? Is there anywhere that people can find you?
I'm on Twitter under Spedding Charlie, because someone already had Charlie Spedding. Someone called Charlotte Spedding calls herself Charlie Spedding. So I'm Spedding Charlie.
Spedding Charlie, awesome.
On Twitter.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
And you found me on Facebook.
Yeah, Facebook page, Charlie Spedding. Standard. Easy. Awesome. And for everyone listening, make sure you follow Ardent Run Club on Instagram and at This Is Ardent on all social media for updates on this podcast and us over here at Ardent. And subscribe to Ardent Run Club so you can be the first to know when the new weekly episodes come out. Before we finish, any last words, Charlie?
No, just thank you. I've enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you so much, Charlie. I've really enjoyed this too. And yeah, this has been Ardent Run Club episode 64 with Charlie Spedding. Hope you learned something. Hope you've been inspired, and I hope you find your fire. See you next time.